Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome my colleague and friend and mentor, Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We go immediately to the question of prestige in the modern world, in the 21st century world of shifting alliances and power centers, Moscow, Beijing, Washington. Gregory, a very good evening to you. Prestige, you write of it most recently in your publication. Why is it important to countries to achieve prestige? Why is it a determinative in countries, nations, sovereign states winning contests with others? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, I've written a lot about prestige as a strategic factor over the years. This latest piece was entitled The Balance of Prestige, Decider of Wars. And I say that more critical than the correlation of forces or the balance of power in a physical sense between militaries of the world is the balance of prestige. And right now, we are seeing that all sovereign states and their governments almost universally have declining prestige. They're all in a situation where their societies don't trust the governments, where governments of one country don't trust another, where there's this insufficient domestic and international harmony, because all states in the prestige stakes and the ratings are very, very weak. And we're about to find out what that means, because at the beginning of 2025, with all of these governments around the world losing their authority or the trust of their societies, are unstable, both from internal opposition and in the international power stakes. So this is going to be very interesting to see how this causes people to behave. For some sovereign leaders, they will attempt to take advantage of an even weaker neighbor, or they need to reassure their own populations that they're still a strong government, so they will attack another nation state in order to demonstrate how powerful that they still are, and hopefully reunite their populations. But we look at the reality is that there is no such thing as absolute unity in any country, and more or less never has been. But we then look at the situation where you've got to see just how much credibility and coercive capability you have before you are forced to rely on either spending big amounts of money or spending big amounts of military power to exert your authority. And we're at the situation now where people are saying, well, the People's Republic of China can go to war with the United States, even North Korea could go to war with the United States, because they perceive this as an ideal opportunity. And so President Trump, being very much conscious of this, of course, has attempted to reassert the persuasive or coercive power of the United States without going to war. And this bombast, if you like, of threats of tariffs against literally all of the United States' major trading powers, namely Mexico, Canada, and the People's Republic of China, was designed to, if you like, force its neighbors onto the back foot. And the U.S. was very fortunate when it was repatriating a lot of these illegal immigrants into the United States, repatriating them back to their own countries. And the government of Colombia, and Colombia was a U.S. ally until the recent elections, the president of Colombia rejected that and wouldn't allow the two U.S. Air Force aircraft to land with the repatriates. As a result, within minutes, President Trump imposed a 25% tariff on all Colombian goods coming to the United States, and the U.S. is one of the biggest receivers of Colombian exports in the Colombian economy. And so the president of Colombia backed down within several hours, and the United States withdrew the coercive tariffs within a couple of hours. So it was a perfectly staged, if you like, a theater of what coercive power can do. And that's based on the potential threat or prestige of the United States in this case. Had Brazil been in that position, it might have been a slightly less persuasive situation. But what we see, and we've stressed this before, is that President Trump has basically, he wrote the art of the deal, but I don't think anybody, even these political observers, have understood what his negotiating strong suit was, or long suit was. And basically, he is forcing partners who see no need at all to negotiate anything, all of a sudden being forced to negotiate because he's put them in a position where they cannot refuse to negotiate. That's the key to his over-the-top threats and imposition of punitive measures like tariffs. These countries, China, Canada, Mexico, said, hey, we're not the sole cause of this problem. We're doing our best, and, we're quite happy with the deal we have. And so they basically were refusing to negotiate. But when Trump said, here's what's going to happen tomorrow morning, and that's game, set, and match, I don't care what you do, you're going to get these tariffs. Well, that forced them to say, okay, well, let's talk about it. And that means you've started a negotiation. And that is absolutely critical in the world of building or rebuilding your coercive capability. I said earlier that I believe that President Trump had no desire whatsoever to impose these exhaustive tariffs on Canada or Mexico, who are so vital to the United States' best interests, but that he was determined to do it in the case of the People's Republic of China, because there it's not just about economic issues, it's particularly about strategic issues. The Chinese are saying that this will erode trust between the two countries. Got news for Beijing. There is absolutely no trust between the PRC and the United States from both ends. So, but with Canada and Mexico, what we saw was President Trump got the negotiations started. He got assistance from both of those states in the immediate sense of helping to seal the northern and southern borders of the United States, and that will dramatically help him, President Trump. Now, we can go back into the argument and say, well, the open borders of the United States caused by the previous administration and by the Obama administration were not the fault of Canada and Mexico, they were the fault of the United States. And the Mexicans and Canadians suffered enormously from having other countries flood through the Canadian and Mexican heartlands towards the U.S. borders. Nonetheless, President Trump is getting the borders secured and having the Mexicans and Canadians partially pay for that, which is literally his negotiating position. So really, we could see Canada and Mexico coming back into the fold very quickly. We've seen Panama coming back into the fold very quickly because of the threats from Washington there, and with the very rapid follow-up by Secretary of State Marco Rubio to a number of countries, but Panama in particular, where Panama is not going to sign up again on the Belt and Road Initiative. It's probably going to cancel the port management and canal management system that it had with Hutchison Whampoa, which was signed long before the Belt and Road Initiative, so that the control, if you like, of the Panama Canal is much more under the United States government and the Panamanian government. Secretary of State Rubio also said, and while you're at it, if you're not going to renew the Belt and Road Initiative, why don't you reopen diplomatic relationships with the Republic of China or Taiwan? So all of this is actually coming into line. Now, can you criticize aspects of this from the efficacy of U.S. policies? Yes, President Trump is achieving his main goals and doing it very, very quickly. But part of the price that is being paid for this is that he has humiliated some of his friends. I'm not saying that it matters whether he humiliated the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, because Trudeau is on his way out anyway. He is hated by the majority of the Canadian public, as all the polls indicate, and he will be out of government within months. And by the end of this year, Canada will be under a new conservative government, which is highly supportive of the US/Western position espoused by President Trump. So don't alienate the Canadians, alienate Trudeau if you want. But there are things to be learned from that, subtleties and nuances, if you like. But and there's more to come. There's the UK-US confrontation, which is about to occur between President Trump and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who is rightly coming in for some punishment from President Trump because of his and his party's stupidity in attacking President Trump during the election campaign and putting British Labour Party supporters into the US to essentially campaign against President Trump and for Kamala Harris. So there's going to be some sorting out there. But at the end of the day, Trump, I think, is building back to getting his objectives secure, renegotiating the borders agreements, keeping trade open. So what we're seeing now is the postponement of tariffs on Canada and Mexico for 30 days, and then there'll be some additional things which I'm sure will work out in favor of the US, Canada, and Mexico. And ultimately, I think President Trump's antagonism with Sir Keir Starmer will result in Starmer losing in an internal power struggle in the British Labour Party, so that he'll be no longer British Prime Minister within months.
Gregory, let's find out where this began, because it started within easy memory, this idea of prestige being necessary in order to win a contest with your allies or your adversaries. So we're going to come back, and it's going to be 2016, the pivot point that Gregory identifies for what is going on now across the European map, and certainly across Asia, too. It's called nationalism. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.